Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to our second of our lecture series for the Great Decisions lecture series. This is our 51st year of hosting Great Decisions at Whitworth University, so we're really excited about the opportunity to keep this great series going, and especially the great speakers that we have lined up for this season. Tonight we have Professor Lindy Scott. He's going to be talking about why Latin America is shifting to the left and why we need to understand our southern neighbors. It's a rare opportunity that we have for Whitworth in general to have Lindy here with us. He's new to Whitworth University in terms of he's just came from Wheaton College in Illinois, and he's been there for quite a while and led a stellar program, and we're really excited to be able to have him here because he embodies so much of what we really treasure at Whitworth. The fact that he's a superb academic scholar, but that the scholarship is also used and engaged in the world today. It's not sort of a detached scholarship that's just in the ivory tower. Real quickly, I'd like to touch on some of his academic or scholastic achievements. He's a professor in the Modern Languages Department here at Whitworth University. He specializes in Latin American history, theology, and the Spanish language. He's currently the editor of the Journal of Latin American Theology, Christian Reflections from the Latino South, and editor of newly released book, Christians in the Care of Creation and Global Climate Change. It's just came out, so this is his new baby. So we're happy to showcase that. Professor Scott was named the Christian Writer of the Year by the Asociación Cristiana de Periodismo in Mexico. So he's not just recognized for his work in the U.S., but also in Latin America as well. I'll work back a little bit. Another book that he worked on in terms of editing, Terrorism and the War in Iraq, A Christian World from Latin America. And then going back, one of the first books that he published that came out of his dissertation, The Salt of the Earth, A Sociopolitical History of Mexico City Evangelical Protestants. So these works reflect the sort of best that Whitworth treasures in terms of the theological elements, but also then being engaged in the world today. Lindy's also engaged in being active in the world. He serves as the USA coordinator for the Latin American Theological Fellowship. He's led a number of tours with students in Latin America. I asked him which countries, and he gave me this long list, and there may be one or two of them that he hasn't been in with students, teaching them in a variety of Latin American countries. He also has lived in Mexico and taught there for 16 years. Despite this extensive international background, as you may be able to tell from his books, he's not somebody who's just concerned about Latin America or all his passions are abroad. In 2006, he also ran for the House of Representatives for a seat in Illinois. So he's really engaged even in local politics. Tonight, Professor Scott brings together the insights of both his academic and engaged world for us to address the topic of why Latin America is shifting to the left and why we need to understand our southern neighbors. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lindy Scott.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming out tonight on this rainy evening. I've added a little bit to the title, if you've seen it in the handout, Why Latin America is Shifting to the Left. We need to understand our southern neighbors if we want to see ourselves more clearly. Come with me 30 years ago to my first teaching job. I was in my mid-20s. Down in Mexico City, I just landed a job at the Instituto Politécnico, the National Technological University, small school of 80,000 students, and I had to get my work papers. But I could begin teaching, and I started to teach, but I still had to sign a bunch of papers. So one day, I taught my classes from 7 until 11. Then I had an appointment with the university lawyer, and then I was going to meet the president of the university and some other head honchos there. And so I put on my coat and tie. I very seldom wear a coat and tie, as you can tell. And so I finished my classes at 11 o'clock. I had 2 hours to kill before I was going to meet with the lawyer and the president. So I had a sandwich. I sat down under a beautiful tree. Mexico has these greatest trees. I mean, this tree was huge. It had big purple flowers in it. It was just gorgeous. I ate my sandwich. I fell asleep. I woke up just in time to run to the class, to meet with the lawyer. As I got to the class to see her, she looked at me. She smiled. She was friendly. She looked at my face. She looked at my hair. Use your creativity. 30 years ago, I had a nice, really good-looking afro. It was good. It was hot. And I thought, what? She must be laughing at me or smiling at me. What's this white dude doing with a nice, good-looking afro? And she looked and smiled. And I signed the papers and we talked, and she presented me to the president. He looked at my afro and smiled and chuckled and laughed. And I met some other people. They all looked at me, and they were so friendly. I thought, wow, Mexico City universities are really great. I'm going to love teaching here. So I finished all I had to do, and I started walking away, and I was walking on the sidewalk, and I walked past a car, and I saw my reflection in the window of the car. And there was a big purple flower in my afro. And I thought, well, the lawyer, she didn't put that flower in my hair. And I realized when I fell asleep, the flower fell upon my good-looking afro. And here for the last 3 hours, I had been walking around, and no one pointed it out to me. Now, there's nothing wrong with wearing flowers in your hair, especially if you're from San Francisco. It's quite appropriate. But it wasn't quite the impression I wanted to make with the president of the university. I desperately needed someone to be a mirror to me, someone, a student. You would think a student would say, hey, professor, do you like purple flowers? Or something like that. But no one said anything, just laughed at me. And I thought, maybe some people tried to get my attention, tried to tell me how I looked, but I was too nervous, I was too occupied with what I was doing, too sleepy, whatever, so I didn't realize it. But I desperately needed a mirror. So this evening, as we look at Latin America and why Latin American countries are shifting to the left, I'd also like to invite you to think, what are they saying to us? What is that mirror that they're holding up to us? Because Latin American countries are our neighbors, our nearest neighbors. We have many things in common, and they are good neighbors. And their shift to the left is telling us something about our own lives, our own politics, our own economics. So follow with me now this journey to see where Latin America is turning and why they're turning. First of all, we need to clarify how we're going to use the words left and right, because there's multiple meanings. There are three basic meanings that I hear over and again. And the first one would be from the Cold War period. Left meant you were siding with Russia, the Soviet Union, or China. If you're on the right, it meant you were siding with the United States, Western Europe. And the lines were pretty closely drawn, and people in Latin America felt like pawns in a chess game. Were they with the left? Were they with the right? A dictator could easily say, I am anti-communist, and would be classified as the right and get a lot of money from the U.S. Or Fidel could say, I'm with Russia and get money from the left. So it was pretty much a political chess game, communism and Western civilization, the free world. And so those were the categories. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, since the fall of Soviet communism, people don't use those terms much, but when they do, they still breed a lot of emotion. I'm not going to use that in that term this tonight. The second sense would be more of an economical sense. The left means greater government intervention in the economic world. It could be minimum wage laws, tariffs, environmental protection laws, subsidies, government ownership of certain companies, postal service, city-owned water company. The right would be the opposite, would be free trade, less government intervention, reprivatization of state-owned companies, trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, etc., the right is usually associated with what's called or what's known as the Washington Consensus. Washington and Western Europe would each have the ability, the governments, to choose the president, director of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And these two institutions were created after World War II to stabilize the international markets. But in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they essentially were saying, we need to privatize everything. We need to help these third world countries become freer, become more capitalistic. And so we will recognize that they have a debt. They can't afford to pay the debt. We will lend them more money if they meet certain criteria. So in that sense, the criteria frequently were, you need to reduce your bureaucratic government, cut jobs, cut expenses in the centralized government. You need to reprivatize companies that are owned by the government, and you need to open your markets to other countries. You need to open your country to investment from outside. So the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was very strong on pushing this right economics, laissez-faire kind of economic system on third world countries, especially in Latin America. In a more political sense today, I would say you hear frequently on different talk shows, in the news, in the newspapers, left means, oh, you're criticizing the United States, especially U.S. foreign policy. And so the right would be you defend U.S. policy. And these last two definitions, the economic definition and the more political, critical of the United States policies kind of definition, frequently overlap, but they we'll try to keep them separate at least for a while. Three observations. It is frequently assumed that the United States is completely on the economic right, that we are a laissez-faire capitalist country. That's not quite true. We have government intervention in many areas, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, minimum wage laws, anti-monopoly laws, environmental protection laws, the U.S. Postal Service, the military-industrial complex. And here's a quote from ex-President Eisenhower. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. He himself, a general, was worried about the influence of the military-industrial complex in our country, and it is hugely greater now than it was 50 years ago. And the U.S. government spends by far the most portion of our budget for military expenses, which are part of this. Subsidies. The United States has many subsidies to agriculture, to the oil industry, bailouts, etc. Secondly, it's sometimes assumed that the economic right is the moral right. Especially in conservative circles, you hear that, oh, the person is leftist as if to discredit what they're saying. And when you think about a sweatshop, and we'll come back to this, I'd like to tell you a story at the end about a sweatshop in Central America. What makes a sweatshop immoral? What makes it wrong? If it's what the economy can bear, if what the market can bear, if you pay a dollar a day because that's what people can make in that country, even if they can't survive on a dollar a day, what makes it wrong? I would say that it's the, from my perspective, the imago Dei, the image of God ethic. According to Christianity and Judaism and Islam, every human being is created in God's image and therefore has tremendous value. And you cannot treat any human being as less than human. You cannot treat any human being and with ridicule or treat a person as if they are not valuable. In fact, in the Christian religion, Jesus said that the way you treat every person, even the littlest person, even the poorest person, is how we treat God. And so the image of God ethic, I think, is very important as we talk about morality left and right. And generally, in conservative circles, the word left is used in a negative way to discredit a person or a policy. And I would say policies should be evaluated on their own merits. You can't discredit and say it's right or left and say it's good or bad. You need to look at what is the policy doing, how does it hurt or benefit people who are made in God's image. Good. Let's go to the second part and look at the shift to the left in the Latin American countries. And I'll give you 6 or 7 examples and a couple of the exceptions to those. And I'm thinking here primarily about in Latin America, since the mid-80s, early 90s, democracy has flourished again. With the end of the Cold War, you can't have dictators appealing to being anti-communist and therefore getting U.S. support. So many dictatorships fell in the 80s, early 90s, Central America, mid-90s. And so democracy is flourishing. And you have many candidates. Sometimes you have 15 or 20 parties in these countries. And so there are many options, and the options tend to be more right of center economically or left of center, more towards free trade, breaking down the tariffs, the barriers, or more government intervention. And with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Soviet Union, in the 90s, in general, there was the thought that, communism has failed us, capitalism is a solution. So there were shifts to the right in the early 1990s. First of all, Argentina. 1989, President Menem was elected, and he became the most pro-capitalist person of all of Latin America. The International Monetary Fund pressured Argentina to sell off its state-owned companies. And so the airlines, the water suppliers, all kinds of government-owned companies were privatized and sold off. Some of these were very bureaucratic, bloated, and needed to be sold off because they were losing money every year. But one that was not was Aerolíneas Argentinas, the national airlines. It was a good airline. It was making money, providing service for all of Argentina and internationally. So the IMF said, you must sell off this company. Now, there aren't a lot of buyers out there for an airline. And so the price comes down. If there's few people bidding on it, the price comes down. So Argentina Airlines was sold for a song and bought by Iberia Airlines from Spain together with American Airlines in the U.S. Iberia then gutted Argentine Airlines, took the best planes, the best routes, the best technology, etc., and then declared bankruptcy. You then had thousands of Argentine airline workers who had worked 5, 10, 20, 30 years in the company who there then did not have any pension because their company was bankrupt. And so here they have contributed saving for their retirement and now no money at all. They take to the streets. Buenos Aires Water Company had to be sold off. Enron took control of that water company. So in the first years, you have $7 million coming in, $7 billion coming into the coffers of the government. So it looks like, wow, reprivatization is working. The turn to the right is working because $7 billion is now in the government. Wow, so Menem looked very good. He also liked to play soccer with the national soccer team, so he was looking pretty good. But once you sell off all your companies, there's no more money coming in. And the IMF told Argentina, peg your peso to the dollar, and you'll essentially eliminate any inflation. So they did. So on the one hand, you have inflation cut. You have selling off of all these companies. Things look pretty good, and there is some investment coming into Argentina. Now, Brazil, country of my wife, Dinora, over here, Brazilians and Argentines don't get along very well. Brazil also had high inflation. The IMF told Brazil, we want you to also peg your currency to the dollar. So they did. So here you have Brazil and Argentina with the same value for their currency. Argentina was, Brazil was also forced to sell off some of their companies, but they didn't do as much. Now, the IMF told Brazil, hey, you guys are having problems. We would like you to devalue your currency. So in 1999, Brazil devalued its currency almost by half. What does that do? It makes Brazilian exports much cheaper than Argentine exports, roughly half. So the Brazilian companies started getting a lot more exports. They started the largest Volkswagen company plant in the world is in Brazil. And they export Volkswagens to Germany and the rest of Europe. So Brazil is the motor that is going great guns in South America. Argentina, on the other hand, can't compete. So Argentina has to start closing its automobile plants, its telephone plants, its television, everything. And so Argentina is told by the IMF, you maintain the parity one-to-one with the dollar. If you want any more loans to cover your back loans, you have to maintain that. And Brazil, you keep devaluating your money. Now, if you're Argentina, you think unemployment is going to increase. Our economy is going to go stale, which it did, 25% unemployment. But on the other hand, the Brazilians said, we're not doing that great. We're producing a lot, but we are getting by on half of the value we had before. Would you like to be told that you are worth half of what you were worth yesterday? No. The U.S. is experiencing a great decline in the value of the dollar. Therefore, gold reached $1,000 an ounce today for the first time. Oil reached $110 a barrel for the first time today. The U.S. dollar is the weakest it's ever been against the euro, the weakest it's been against the yen in over a decade. So we are experiencing a gradual decline in the value of our currency. Brazil lost half at one time. Argentina. Let's go back to Argentina. The IMF said, freeze your salaries. Freeze your government salaries, government workers. So they did. So they could not have any increase in salaries, but prices were going up. And so people took to the streets and they protested. And finally, there was a word, you know, we're going to have to devalue our currency to keep up with Brazil. Once the rumor is out that you're going to devalue your currency, what do? If you have pesos, you're going to buy dollars. You want a solid currency. So there was a run on the banks in Argentina. The president resigned. A new president came in, he resigned. Another one came in, he resigned. Six presidents in a month. In a month. There was a run on the money and they couldn't do it. So finally, Argentina devalued their currency. And it went from 1-to-1 to 4-to-1 overnight. All the people who had shifted their money into dollars could now shift it back and buy four times as much land, companies, plants, homes, whatever. People who have money can make a killing off of these devaluations. Common people who live hand to mouth cannot. So, Argentina said, we must move back to the left. We need people who will defend us and not defend the interests of others. And so, President Néstor Kirchner was elected in 2003. His wife was elected in 2007. So you see that in general, Argentina likes the shift to the left that the Kirchners have brought. Brazil, it devalued its currency in 1999. So the Brazilians were making half as much money compared to the rest of the world. And so people had a job, but they couldn't make enough to live on. So Lula, who was a labor union worker who had run for president two previous times, ran again and was elected in 2002. He is from the Workers' Party, a very much left of center, very much pro-worker, anti-capitalist party. And he was re-elected in 2006. In Bolivia, in 2005, an indigenous leader, Evo Morales, from the Movement Towards Socialism Party. Take a guess what that means. He was elected, and he said, the state needs to recover ownership, possession, and total and absolute control of hydrocarbons. So here again, it's a move to the left to say, you know, we tried going laissez-faire free capitalism. It did not work. Capital came in and took advantage of our cheap labor and cheap resources. We need to have control of our resources, our gas or our oil. Chile. Since 1990, the Concertación Party, it's a group of different parties, has won. And the last two presidents have been socialists, Ricardo Lagos and Michelle Bachelet. And so Chile has moved to the left. Although Chile loves selling their products, their wine, their fruits, their vegetables to us, their summer is our winter, so they love to sell. We are one of the leading partners for Chile's products. Nicaragua, the Sandinista Daniel Ortega from the Sandinista Revolution, 1979 to 1990. He was leader and then elected president in 85. There were elections in 1990. He lost, and he turned over the government to a right-of-center candidate. There was a good transition. So there again you see a left-wing, leftist kind of leader worked in the 80s, but in the 90s it moved to the right. He was just recently elected president, although the United States worked against him and tried to have him defeated. He was elected president in 2006. Venezuela, we all know about Hugo Chavez. He helped Argentina more recently. What's he doing? He's having some troubles at home, but he's got oil. And what's he doing with the oil at $110 a barrel? He's befriending other Latin American countries and saying, you know, don't go with the U.S. plan for a free trade zone that'll benefit them. Let's go with an all Latin American trade agreement. And you know, Argentina, you defaulted on your loans to the IMF. I will help you get out of that bankruptcy. And so it's happened. Country after country is now freed from their debt to the IMF because of Hugo Chavez. He is buying support, setting people free, in his words. Is he a true socialist? Not if you look at what he does in his internal policies, his own country, but he is a thorn in the U.S. side. Two exceptions, Colombia and Mexico. Colombia receives more financial aid from the United States than all the other Latin American countries and the Caribbean put together. It's a long-term relationship. It is designed to fight terrorism, but also designed to eradicate the production of cocaine. It hasn't worked very much. The fumigation of the Colombian lands has made the lands infertile, so now the cocaine production has shifted to farther away and has now spilled over into Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, etc. But the demand is still high. There's a big value on it, and so the production is still increasing around the world. Mexico is a very unusual case. Mexico had one party govern the country for the entire 20th century, the PRI party, from 1929 to 2000. 1988, there was a governor from the PRI party, son of a previous president, who said, the party is so corrupt, we need to start a new party, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. He was there. He broke from the PRI, started a new party, left of center, and he was drawing huge crowds. People were thinking of his father when they saw him. So here he was drawing huge crowds, and he was challenging the PRI and the third party of the PAN in the election. He won, by far, the election in Mexico City, where you had good voter counting and reliability. The election was on a Sunday. A few days later, the results were coming in, and the computer crashed. When it crashed, he was winning by 1 million votes. When it came back up, he was losing by 1 million votes. People took to the street, they protested, and yet the United States said, we recognize the pre-candidate as the winner. It is very difficult for ordinary citizens to protest what they think is a fraudulent election if the big colossus to the north recognizes the opponent. That president then implemented NAFTA. Some would say that it was in compensation for the U.S.'s recognition of him as the president. Mexico, up until that time, would only allow 49% controlling interest by any foreign entity in a Mexican business. That is gone. The U.S., Germany, France, anyone can now invest in Mexico and produce and take advantage of the cheap labor, etc. Finally, in 2000, people were tired of the corruption of the PRI, and they voted not for the left-of-center party, but the right-of-center party, PAN. President Fox won. And then 2006, Calderón, the PAN candidate, got 35.89%, and the left-of-center candidate, López Obrador, 35.31%. Many people feel that it was a fraudulent election. They took to the streets. But what do you do? Why was this shift to the right in the 90s and has it come back in the last 8 or 10 years? Free market capitalism has not delivered all that it has promised. In general, Latin American gross domestic product of each country is doing fairly well because they have oil, Brazil, Venezuela, Mexico. They have silver, they have gold, they have iron, they have copper. So the commodities that they produce are doing well. Yet the gap between the richest and the poorest has been large and is getting even larger. Joblessness is higher now than it was in 1990. 40% of Latin Americans live in poverty. NAFTA has increased unemployment in Mexico. NAFTA has wiped out certain industries in the United States, the textile industry. It's wiped out certain industries in Mexico as well. The second installment of NAFTA was in the area of agriculture. And so now Canadian and U.S. agribusiness can go into Mexico, can buy up land, and with machinery can produce better than a peasant produces on his or her own 2 acres. And so 2 million Mexican corn growers have had to sell out their farm, their 2 acres, to the bigger companies. Where are those 2 million Mexicans? They try to find jobs in the cities, but they can't find jobs in the cities. They believe in good capitalism. Devaluations, whether IMF induced or not, are devastating. Most of the gains go to those companies that can get a bigger portion of the international market. But most people can't get that. Most people are not in that. So your salaries stay the same or go down in relative purchasing power, and certain people make off like bandits, but others don't. Latin American says, especially Mexico, there is a selective capitalism going on. According to true laissez-faire capitalist theory, the most efficient system is when you have a free flow of capital, of natural resources, of finished goods, and of labor. If the government intervenes and stops the flow of any of those four, it will become less efficient. We see that with Europe. The European market union now has one currency. People from Italy can work in Spain, can work in France, vice versa. And so there's free movement. There's one currency. Things are going better. Europe is more efficient now because of that. NAFTA said free flow of capital, products, natural resources, but not labor. The going minimum wage in the United States, $6, $7 an hour, $50 a day. In Mexico at the northern border, $5 a day. If I made $5 a day and had 3 kids and a spouse, and I couldn't make it on those $5 a day, what would I do? I'd probably cross the border and flip hamburgers. Central America, about $3 or $4 a day. So companies from the U.S., Canada, other places have moved to the Mexican border and formed factories, maquiladoras, what they're called, and they take advantage of the cheap labor. But then President of Nicaragua, President of Guatemala says, why don't you come to our country, and here you can pay $3 a day. So there's a rush to the bottom. Who can pay the least amount of wages? And India and China says $2 a day in our country. So Mexico and other countries have seen capital come into the country, but now capital leaving, and some of the maquiladoras that were started in the 90s have now been shut down, and the workers don't have jobs, and the jobs have been shipped overseas. A shift back towards the left. Let's look more at the criticisms of U.S. policy. Latin America has a love-hate relationship with the United States. It has loved the U.S. ideals, democracy, balance of power, freedom. Many of the Latin American countries have based their constitution on the U.S. Constitution. Nevertheless, they feel that we do not live up to our ideals. There's a general anger and frustration about the Washington consensus. Argentine said, we played by the rules. We did everything that the IMF, controlled by the United States, told us to do. We obeyed completely, and look what happened. We were devalued 400%. So there's frustration that we played by the rules, but it didn't get us anywhere. A more recent tendency, it's disconcerting for them, and it's a growing tendency, is that they see signs that the United States considers itself above the law. The biggest, clearest example would be the invasion of Iraq. According to the UN Charter that the United States helped write, a country can go to war in self-defense without asking permission of anyone. It can go to war to help a third party, like Kuwait, when Kuwait was attacked by Iraq some 15 years ago. But it can do that only if the United Nations authorizes that war. George Bush Sr. got that authorization for the first Gulf War. Colin Powell went to the UN Security Council, made his argument, saying Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. On the Security Council, we have the 5 permanent members, but another 10 members, a total of 15, and these other 10 members rotate according to the regions. Latin America has 2 spots on those rotating members, and it was Chile and Mexico in 2002-2003. President Fox, very good friends with President Bush. Chile considers us their main buyers of their products. 2 very good neighbors for us. To authorize war, the Security Council says you need a supermajority. 9 of the 15 members need to approve that authorization. United Kingdom, Spain, and the United States floated a proposal asking for permission to take out Saddam. And you all remember Colin Powell made a very dramatic presentation to the UN Security Council. And it came down that 8 countries had approved it, 5 had not authorized the invasion of Iraq, and the 2 Latin American countries were the last ones to state their position. President Bush tried to sweeten the deal with President Fox of Mexico and said, if you vote in favor, I will get green cards for your 10 million citizens working in our country. That was tempting. But 95% of Mexicans were against the imminent invasion of Iraq. President Fox himself had just won election, and there were 2 other parties fighting him in Congress, so he did not have a majority of the country with him electorally, and he didn't have the majority of the country with him on the authorization. So he said, President Bush, I cannot go with you. Chile said, I cannot go with you. Now, Chile is an exceptional case because Latin America grieved over 9/11. Latin America felt that the United States had suffered a loss. 3,000 lives were taken on 9/11. And so they said, we feel the pain that you suffer because we've also suffered civil wars. We've also suffered terrorist attacks in our countries. Now, most Latin American college students, when you say 9/11, would think of not 2001, but 1973. Chile had elected a president, a democratically elected president, Allende, in 1970. He was a socialist, but elected, and he was introducing certain changes into Chile. Some people did not like that. The United States did not like that, and so our own CIA, together with some generals, rebellious generals, had a coup d'etat, and we took out President Allende on September 11th, 1973. We put in General Pinochet, and in the next 15 years, he authorized the killing of 30,000 Chileans. And so when Chile was asked to vote, do you approve of the invasion of Iraq? Chile looked at its own people. It looked at the lack of evidence regarding weapons of mass destruction and said, we cannot. Latin Americans, by and large, feel that President Bush violated the UN Charter by going to war without the authorization. You may agree or not agree with their interpretation, but that's how they see it. And they say, the United States, you failed to live up to the UN Charter. You failed in international democracy. You, who taught us democracy, have failed by not living up to the UN Charter. It's hypocrisy. Because you claim that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Well, he did have them. He used them against the Kurds back in the 80s and the 90s, and you approved of him then. You supplied him with those weapons. And now you dump him because he's challenging you. He's no longer fits in your plans. We've seen that before because Noriega, the dictator in Panama, was on the CIA payroll for 20 years, and then you dumped him. And so Latin America says, we've seen how you establish or support dictators in our continent, and then you turn on them when they no longer fit in your plans. This probably is what's happening in Iraq. And the United States has a history of justifying invasions in Latin America, claiming that it's for the good of the Latin Americans, but, for example, 1846, President Polk sent a commission to Mexico to ask Mexico if they would sell the rest of Texas, Nuevo Mexico, Arizona, California, y Colorado. President Santana said, gracias, pero no gracias. We don't want to sell it. A few months later, U.S. troops marched into Mexican land, and the Mexican soldiers defended their land and killed a few soldiers, U.S. soldiers. President Polk said, that is grounds for war. A little-known congressman from Illinois said, show me on the map where those soldiers were killed. Was it U.S. territory or Mexican territory? He introduced a bill into Congress known as the Show Me the Map. And that Congressman Lincoln lost that discussion. The amendment passed in the Congress declaring that President Polk had done an imperialistic war attack against a neighbor. And in the end, the United States gets Colorado, Nuevo Mexico, Arizona, California, Mexico, Nuevo Mexico, and parts of Texas. Mexicans still feel bad about that theft. U.S. Grant, who fought in the war, said it's the worst, most immoral war that a bigger country has fought against its neighbor. There have been invasions of Chile, of Guatemala in 54, of Nicaragua and Panama, and on and on. So Latin America says, we've seen invasions. We hear that they're done for good reasons. We don't see the fruits of those. There's a few other quick things I'd like to say, and then we'll open up for questions. Latin Americans say Guantanamo. Why didn't the United States abide by the Geneva Conventions regarding torture? Why does even this week President Bush not sign a statement saying we will not practice torture, waterboarding, ever? And why do we have a naval base in Cuba? If Cuba had a naval base in Spokane... on the Little Spokane River? What will we do? If Canada sent some Mounties across the border and established a base, what would we do? We have a naval base in foreign land. Every year we write a check to then, for the last 50 years, to then President Capitan Fidel Castro. Every year he would write, he would send the check back and say, we don't accept your occupation of our land. And so we don't want your rent money. The Kyoto Protocol. Why won't the United States take the lead on carbon emissions controls? We are the biggest users of carbon. We are 5% of the world's population. We emit 35, 40, 45% of the world's carbon. We are contributing to global warming, in my opinion. But we will not abide by any international protocol or convention. And if we don't, other countries say, why should we? If the giant doesn't do it, why should we? The U.S. asked the International Criminal Court in 2004 in The Hague, could you give special immunity to U.S. soldiers? Because we're the world's policemen. We are fighting against terrorism around the world. And could you just give immunity to our soldiers? What other country asks for immunity for their soldiers? If a U.S. soldier, if a Canadian soldier, if a Cuban soldier does something wrong, rapes a person from another country, that person should come under the judgment of the local court, of the national court. But we ask for immunity. Since 9/11, the U.S. has essentially ignored Latin America. Another factor for this is that Chavez has oil. He has oil. If he would cut off the spigot tonight and say, United States, I will not sell you any more oil, what would happen? Supply and demand, we would see oil up to $150 a barrel, probably. We'd see gas up to $7, $8 a gallon. He has that power. Would he use it? Probably not. If he would cut off the spigot, would the United States invade Venezuela? Much of Latin America has valuable commodities that the rest of the world wants. 8 years ago, we were the only superpower standing. We don't have that position anymore. Europe is as close to Brazil as we are. China, India are buying tons of all these commodities. So Latin America does not depend on the United States as it used to. What do we learn about ourselves in the Latin American mirror? I wanted someone 30 years ago to say, Lindy, you've got some flowers in your hair, and they look great. Or they look horrible, or they look crazy, they look funny. But I needed someone to tell me the truth. But no one spoke. I think Latin America is trying, through their elections, through their democracies, through their statements, through their complaints, through their approvals, they're trying to say, United States, it's a new day, it's a new world. Don't be the self-righteous bully that we've known you to be. Live up to your better angels. Live up to your better ideals. Live up to what your Constitution says. Live up to your Statue of Liberty. Live up to what you claim are the guiding principles. If we want to change and grow, we must intentionally seek out constructive criticism. How many of you seek out constructive criticism? How many of you say, roommate, please tell me my flaws? Married couples, how many of you say that to your spouse? Tell me my flaws. Stop at 10, por favor. It's hard to be intentional because we know we have flaws. We're fallen people. But my faith and other faiths of the world say, you know, we are fallen people. There is forgiveness. But we need to recognize, we need to confess our failures individually, systemically, structurally, nationally. And we can change, but we need to be intentional. The trouble is we are your generation, students, and my generation of people here, we live in the most technologically advanced period of the human history, human world. We can have access to any, almost any newspaper in Latin America. Go online and you can get it. But we don't. I think we need to be very intentional about seeking out what others think of us, which means plug, study a second language. Keep me in business teaching Spanish. Study a second language, French, German, whatever, Russian, Greek. Study a language so you can know what people really think, what they really think about us, what they think about the world situation, what their hearts and minds are doing. Look on the web for newspapers that have a translation into English if you don't speak their language. The journal that we published of the Latin American theology was an attempt, because not everyone speaks God's and Cervantes' language. We need to publish in English. And this is a chance for us to learn what Latin Americans are saying. We need to look at life from the perspective of others, the Imago Dei, the image of God ethic. And I'd like to close with a story. It's a sad story. It's a true story. I was visiting a student, a university student in Honduras. He was working in microfinance, helping out a microfinance company, small loans, $100, $200, mostly to women so they could buy a sewing machine or they could have a mom-pop store or something. But these women, with a $200 loan, were making it. And so he was helping them with these microfinance loans. He was also in a Bible study, and there was a young lady, 16-year-old young lady in the study, and her father was sick, and so she asked for prayer for the father. She and the father were the only breadwinners. She worked in the maquiladora in town, the factory, $3 a day. The father got so sick that he could not continue working. He stayed home. On $3 a day, she could not provide food and medicine for her family. She stopped coming to the Bible study at the church. And my student went to see what had happened because she missed 3 or 4 weeks. And she said, I had to find a different job. And there aren't many good jobs in Honduras that pay more than $3 a day. But there are 2 military bases in town, a Honduran military base and a U.S. military base. And a friend of mine asked me if I would like to make $25 a night. So I go there on Friday nights and Saturday nights, and I clear $50, giving the soldiers a good time. She had to sell her body to save her family. Now, when I heard that, I did not know what to do. It's like you're up against a monster, and you can't, it's hard to fix what is broken in this sense. But to love her and say, let's find another solution, let's do something, means you need to change the rules of the game. You need to somehow bring capital into the country that will change the country. We've all heard of free trade, but also fair trade, coffee, fair trade, chocolate, fair trade, many things. But if it's fair, then it insinuates that the free trade agreements that we do are not fair. It's not a level playing field. There's not a free flow of labor and resources. And so we do need to change the system. And that's why some of the Latin American governments are saying we need to swing back to the left and provide a system that is cares for the common good of all the citizens and not the gain of a few. I'd like to stop here, open up for questions. I don't know if I have any answers, but at least we'll hear some good questions.
Any And again, I know that there may be a class that needs to leave, so if you could do that as sort of quickly and quietly as possible, I'll run around and see if we can hand the microphone to different people. We should have 20 or 25 minutes here of questions.
I had a question regarding the invasion of Iraq and Mexico's role on the Security Council having a deciding vote. You made a claim that Bush tried to sway Fox into voting, I mean not Fox, but Mexico into voting yes for the war in supply, providing a green card for 10 billion Mexicans in the United States. Where's your evidence for that? Because I've never heard that before until tonight. I'm just interested.
There are several newspaper reports from reputable Mexican newspapers in 2002, 2003. I don't have them here with me, but I can get those for you. And to be fair to President Bush, he tried to get comprehensive immigration reform as president, even without Fox authorizing the war. He didn't have the support or enough support from Republicans from his own party and from some Democrats. So he was in favor of immigration reform. So he was offering to Fox what he was in agreement with anyway.
My question would be, with the countries that the IMF is currently investing in, a lot of countries in Africa, a lot of countries in Asia, do you see this same backlash occurring there in the near future after the IMF withdraws or fails?
Everyone heard the question? What might happen in Africa and in Asia, the same backlash towards the free trade, free markets? I think it depends on the country and what the country can sell. If it can sell something on the global market, and if the global market continues to heat up, China and India, in spite of the recession of the U.S., then I think the country will say, hey, this is great, this is the best thing going. But if a country is poor and does not have access to anything that they can sell, they will say, this is not fair. People are taking advantage of us. The trouble is, most of these maquiladoras are in countries that can produce and ship quickly. And so Mexico has an advantage there. The coasts of Central America do. The Asian Rim, Pacific Rim does. So there's certain countries geographically well situated. Others are not. Bolivia and Paraguay are not because they don't have a coast.
Not knowing another language or reading papers from other countries, we have National Public Radio. Could you give us some idea of how you see National Public Radio going some distance to help us understand issues and maybe target a few of the favorite ones that you would like to hear people listen to?
I like National Public Radio because, in general, they try to present the different sides of an issue. I'm very leery of the ownership of the mass media and how it conditions us, how it leads us to think in certain directions. So I really force myself to watch and listen the media that I disagree with, because I want to hear opposite sides from what I already believe. I think NPR does a pretty good job on immigration. It does a pretty good job on revealing human life stories in other countries. It does a pretty good job of saying, like for Costa Rica, CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, was passed. And here's another problem. Central American countries have a term limit of one period for the president. So the president serves. He can make decisions. And then he doesn't have to come up for election again. And most Central American presidents are now, ex-presidents, are either in jail or in Miami. And so CAFTA was approved by the U.S., and all the Central American countries just accepted it, except Costa Rica, which is the most democratic country in Latin America. And they said, we're going to have a referendum on this election to see if we really want CAFTA to take place, Free Trade Agreement of Central America. And 3 days before the election, before the referendum, the polls said it would lose by about 15%. It ended up winning. And so they think there was voter fraud. So I think NPR can do a good service by pointing out, there's an election in another country. There are claims to voter fraud in that country. Over here.
You know, during the time that the civil wars were going on in Central America, there was and in South America, there was a rise in theology that supported equality and with liberation theology. And I know you're aware of that. We travel some in Central America, and we were in Nicaragua several years ago.
Speak up, please.
We were in Nicaragua several years ago, and we only found one church that would admit to having practiced or still believing and practicing in liberation theology today. Is there any similar movement that parallels the one politically that you're talking about that actually gives expression to theology that talks about wealth for all peoples?
Liberation theology flourished under the dictatorships because there was great human injustice, and there was not a legal system to redress that. And so Christians, largely Catholics, some Protestants, said, we need to liberate the whole human being. And so liberation theology flourished, and it questioned the power struggles of the government, but also of the hierarchical structures within the church. And people began to take things into their own hands, bringing water to their town, or putting in paved streets, or sewage systems, or whatever. So there was a strong emphasis from the church empowering people at the local level. With the fall of communism, with the fall of the dictators, and with a return to democracy, largely the Catholic Church has said, now we do have a channel to express our preferences. And so liberation theology has died out a little bit, I mean, largely. I think the Catholic Church, current pope, previous pope, didn't like that you give too much power to the people. That's what happened with Martin Luther. You set people free, and they're not going to submit to the old structures. And so there was an intentional effort by the hierarchy to appoint conservative bishops and archbishops throughout Latin America, and to encourage charismatic Christianity within the Catholic Church, at the expense of liberation theology. So the charismatics in Latin America are flourishing. The charismatics spend a lot of time praising God, but they don't get involved in politics. Not as much. Now, there are exceptions. In the Protestant world, the charismatic Pentecostal churches are growing, and many within that movement feel God has placed us as the head over society and not the tail. You will hear that phrase quite a bit. And so you'll see many charismatic Protestants, Pentecostals, running for office and getting elected. Some have had good seasons of power within the government, and some have had horrible seasons of power. There is a Pentecostal and a Baptist block of Congress people in Brazil, and they vote as a block, and they vote for certain issues that are dear to their hearts, and they negotiate, and they'll say, if you vote for my issue, I will vote for your issue. So it's a buying and selling of votes. So you see that movement within some parts of the Protestant church, and you also see some Protestants in Latin America since 1920 to 1980, roughly, were suffering the consequences of the fundamentalist, modernist debates in the United States, and so most Protestants tended to be conservative, but tended to be apolitical. God does not call us to get involved in society. That was not the early Protestantism. Early Protestantism in Latin America was very much involved in schools, in politics, in health issues. So now there is a recovery of that holistic view of the gospel affecting your body as well as your soul, as well as democracy and freedom. So there is a growing group of Protestants, and I would say it's probably the majority now, that believe in holistic gospel, holistic ministry, integral ministry is what they would call it. So I see some hopeful signs. I don't see the government solving all the problems because it's bigger than an individual country.
Would you please address what happened last week in Colombia with the movement of the Ecuadorian and Venezuelan troops to the border?
Okay. Colombia during the 80s and 90s had a lot, many Colombians felt the government was corrupt and ineffective. So you had two groups, the FARC, which is the largest rebellious group, that said, this government is corrupt, we need to take over. So it was a civil war, a terrorist group, if you wish to call it that, but it was a revolution. And the FARC and these other groups controlled over half of Colombia's territory. Colombia is a very unique situation in that it was the place where you grow coca. Coca is good for medicinal reasons, but they changed, you can transform the coca into cocaine. Okay, so it's the largest producer of cocaine, the Colombian cartels, the drug cartels. So the government was corrupt, and it was getting money from the narco drug traffickers. The FARC and these other rebel groups were getting money from the drug trafficking. And the question was, who's going to control the land, all this territory where we produce the coca? And so people would come and say, grow coca for us. And the farmer says yes or he gets killed. And another, the opposite group, would come and say, grow coca for us. So it's very difficult to be neutral. So Colombia has had an exodus from the countryside to the city. It is 78% urban today. And so the countryside is deserted. It's had fumigation, so nothing grows there. And the FARC still exists. And they put in schools, they put in clinics, so there is a rebel group that says, we are a better government than the Colombian government. Now, most Colombians are tired of civil war. The U.S. says, we will give you money, President Uribe, to fight the drugs, to fumigate, and to fight the terrorist groups. And so there's a right-wing death squad kind of group that goes up and down in numbers. And the U.S. Congress has to certify that the government and the right-wing death squad are not committing human rights violations for us to keep on giving them money. But money that we give or weapons we give to the government end up in the hands of the right-wing death squads. Anyway, everyone's got a lot of money from the drugs. And so if you're a rebel group, the best thing to do is to attack, take out a city, take out a power line, take out whatever you want to take out, and then cross over into a neighboring country's territory. Because supposedly Colombia would not invade Ecuador, because that would be a violation of their national sovereignty. Colombia said, the leader of the FARC, one of the main leaders, has gone into Ecuador, so we're going to go get him. And we did. We took him out. Ecuador says, what are you doing invading our land? And Chavez says, what are you doing invading Ecuador's land? So Chavez is criticizing the U.S. through the Colombian invasion of Ecuador. Now the OAS, the Organization of American States, is the Western Hemisphere body that tries to resolve conflicts like these, trade conflicts, but also military conflicts. And so the overwhelming majority of the OAS countries condemned Colombia. The United States defended Colombia. But there again, you just get the panorama of all of Latin America feels the U.S. has its own interests at stake and does not want to hear or receive a criticism. Colombia was rebuked. Colombia, it looks like they have settled down the situation. I don't think it's going to erupt much more in the near future, but it was that kind of situation. I forget, at my age, the numbers sort of get mixed up, but it's huge. It's the third largest receiving country for U.S. aid, and it's huge amounts. And many have strings attached that we give you this money, but you have to buy weapons from us. And there again, it's, the U.S. government is subsidizing the military, industrial military complex. Yes.
What's holding Latin America from breaking out of it like China did and developing their company, their country, and becoming wealthy?
I think some countries are breaking out of it. Chile is breaking out. Now, Chile is a strange thing. It has had currently a socialist president, a previous socialist president. It is socialist, and the United States took out Allende, who was socialist back in the 70s during the Cold War. Now, a socialist is not a problem. So internally, Chile is quite socialist. Externally, it's exporting its wine and its fruits and its vegetables to us and to Asia. So Chile is doing, is prospering quite well. Brazil. Brazil is producing, it's huge producing ethanol. Now, I'm not convinced that ethanol is the best non-oil solution, but it's what Brazil is doing, but at the expense of the Amazon forest. And so Brazil is producing, but who's protecting the Amazon? And we all need the oxygen from the Amazon. So I think certain countries are doing well. Venezuela is producing huge amounts. Mexico, with its huge oil reserves, is raking in the money. But it's not going to all the people. So that's a big question. Do we believe that a government has the function of some redistribution? My faith would tell me yes. I see examples in the Old Testament of the government redistributing the reserves, the forgiving the debts, etc. And the law of the year of Jubilee. So I see some of that should take place. Countries should invest in education and health. Costa Rica does not have a military. Honduras does, Guatemala does, these other countries do. So Costa Rica can take its 25% of its budget that other countries put into military, and Costa Rica puts it into education. Every single school in Costa Rica had a computer as of 10 years ago. Computers for their kids. I mean, a whole classroom of computers. You think, goodness gracious, 10 years ago, every school out in the boonies had their computers. Costa Rica is improving. It's doing quite well. Whitworth University is going to have a campus in Costa Rica, Lord willing, in the near future. So I think some countries are doing well. Some countries are receiving a lot of money for their gold, copper, oil, but it's not being shared well, whether it's distributed across the board or put into education and health and roads and infrastructure.
So this is not Latin America's first swing to the left. It's probably their most successful swing because of democracy being in place and it being by choice. But I'm wondering if you have seen yourself any historical patterns that relate to why it swings back and forth, if there's anything related to U.S. foreign policy specifically or global situations, et cetera, historical patterns that relate right to back and forth swings.
Whenever the U.S. is acting like the world's policeman, whether it's Vietnam or more recently in Iraq, there tends to be more polarization. During the Cold War, the U.S. And the Soviet Union used Latin America as the chess match. And so if there is a dictator in your country and he says that he's pro-capitalism, anti-communism, and you just want agrarian reform, you are treated as a communist. So if you're going to protest, you have to be considered as a leftist. And socialism was attractive, especially with Cuba in its heyday and Nicaragua in its heyday, it looked like, oh, socialism can take root in Latin America. But during the Cold War, it was just impossible to make any of those lasting changes. In fact, Ortega probably lost in Nicaragua the election in 1990, not because socialism or his brand of socialism didn't work, but because if you have Contras fighting against you, and they're going to keep on fighting as long as you are there, you can't win if the superpower says you're not going to win. So I think there's been a swing to the left in the 60s, but then the military dictators took over. 64, military takeover in Brazil, 73 in Chile, 76 in Argentina. So you just see them right down the line, because a military dictator would only have to say, I'm anti-communist, and we get the U.S. support. Now, we don't have the Cold War. You can't claim to be anti-communist and get much support. But you can say, I'm anti-terrorist, and I'll be supportive of the U.S. in its war against terrorism. But that's why you can elect socialists in Chile and get by with it, and that's not a problem. Chile is a great partner with the United States. And that's where I don't think it's ideology in the classic sense. U.S. bases its interests economically, politically, but not so much on ideology, because we're not a capitalist country. We don't believe in the free flow of labor, although some capitalists in the United States like cheap labor, or like more Latin Americans to come to the United States. But in general, our country says, no, we don't want that. So there's a reaction against NAFTA, even in the U.S., by Hillary, Barack, and McCain.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question over here, and then if need be, we can have a little bit more discussion up front.
Yes, could you contrast Salvador Allende's socialism with Fidel Castro's version? What was the difference? I get the impression there was quite a bit.
The difference between Salvador Allende, the socialist elected president in Chile in 1970, versus Castro. Grassroots democracy. Allende was elected, and it was not advocating that he could repeat as president. Most governments in Latin America only allowed one term in office, and so he was not advocating changing that rule as Fujimori did in Peru, for example. Castro was in power for 50 years, but Allende was more interested in nationalizing some of the industries, the minerals especially. And when you try to nationalize something and say the government is going to take over control of this industry, the owners of those industries don't like it. In 1938, Cárdenas, the father of Cuauhtémoc, Lázaro Cárdenas, nationalized Mexico's oil industry. And Chevron and Standard Oil and Shell didn't like it. But the Catholic Church came to his defense, and the Protestants came to his defense. The founder of Wycliffe was a good friend with Cárdenas, and he made a trip to the universities and to Congress in the United States defending Cárdenas. And the U.S. did not want to go to war with Mexico in 1938 with things happening over in Europe. So there have been nationalizations of industries, and sadly, countries say, we would like to nationalize the fruit company or the oil industry. Standard Oil, how much are you worth? Oh, we'll look at your taxes you paid last year. You declared that you were worth such and such. We will buy you out for such and such. And that's what Cárdenas did. And the Standard Oil people said, we really are worth three times that much. They declared less to pay fewer taxes, which many companies, many individuals do that. And so the government is just paying what they declared was their fair share, what they were worth. So that's common. But so Allende tried to nationalize the minerals of his country. The United States didn't want him elected to begin with, and then found a way to get him out. Thank you very much. I'll be here to talk to you. Want to talk some more?
Yes, please. Just a last quick reminder that the week after spring break, we'll have our next speaker in the Great Decisions series. Former Ambassador Timothy Carney will be talking about the end game in Iraq. So please join us then as well.